video tonight. This video here is not a video that can be found on the internet. Actually, it's to a closed and private audience, of which my family happened to be a part of. And we were able to be a part of this. It's called the Founders Weekend, and it's invitation only for close supporters of the ministry, where we spend a weekend where everybody around the world kind of comes back in together. The whole entire RZIM team from around the world comes back on this weekend and meets, and then kind of debriefs and goes over the year. And this is really part of a 2.5-hour morning session. You only get 20 minutes of it here. But the morning session is 2.5 hours as we get to hear from the itinerant apologists all over the world. And it's really exciting stuff. It puts iron in the blood and, you know, just fire in the bones. And so I love going there every year. And anywhere we can, if we're able to go, we go. And no matter where it is in the country. So we're going to need to. So anyway, any of you who got to hear Ravi last night or this morning from the TD blog, you know what a treat it was. And if you haven't, I'm sending you to the TD blog to get there. These are landmark messages there that really were given before people really knew about Ravi Zacharias, but really launched him. The first two messages on the blog were given at a Ligonier conference. Which is a national conference, and he was. By the way, it's not the sound isn't on. He was the low man on the totem pole speaker out of all the speakers at the conference. He was the guy like, who's this guy? Why is he at this conference giving a message? What happened was that those messages became the most popular messages of the conference by far. And as a, you know, this is a testimony to the faith that R.C. Sproul has, because if you know the way sometimes Christian ministries work, they sometimes do a lot of gatekeeping and are scared to let the people who support them get exposed to anybody else. What R.C. did after he heard these messages and after they saw the response, R.C. took the message and sent it. He has something called, back then, Tape of the Month, where he sends one of his messages to his entire constituency, you know, which is numbers in the tens of thousands. And then what he did is, instead of his message, he took Ravi's message and sent it out to everybody. And so on the national scale in the Christian world, Ravi started to get known, because after I heard that, I said, I got to go find out more about this guy. I got to go find out whatever he's got. I got to have it. And so he was already well known in certain circles and whatnot, but not on the national and grand scale that Ligonier was able to provide for him. The other one was the atheism one on the blog is a landmark one, because it was at the very first Veritas Forum ever done at the campus of Harvard University on Harvard Law School's campus. And it was done during a time when the school was super busy. They were thinking, this is the wrong weekend to do this. Nobody's going to show up. And it was packed to overflowing. After Ravi gave his presentations and then had the Q&A sessions over a couple days, it swelled. People's lives were being changed. This was a defense in the public circle on the uniqueness of Jesus Christ. And the impact that it had on this secular audience was amazing. And so Chuck Colson, who was a very, very popular, very big figure in the Christian world, after he heard it, he called up Ravi and he said, Ravi, you have to put this into a book. This is too, we can't just keep it in this form. We have to get it to readers out there. You have to put it into a book. And so that's what happened. Word Publishing came in and they published the book, and it became not only a bestseller, but it became an award winner and a key point of his ministry that has been used to change the hearts of skeptics and atheists alike. So you've got a chance to see some of this if you take a look at the blog. If you didn't hear it, hear it. I'm telling you, it's powerful stuff. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and give you an opportunity here in just a second. What I want to do today is I want to give you an opportunity to be around greatness. And you know, as I keep telling you, if you have an opportunity to be around greatness, what? seize it. Thank you. So I want you to seize it. Now this, so this, like I said, this is a report, as a small report done to the constituents, to the supporters of the ministry, as to maybe just a little flavor of the year 2012. But you got to understand the breadth and the depth of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, helping the believer think and helping the thinker believe. The mission of Ravi Zacharias Ministries is this: to reach and challenge those who shape the ideas of a culture with the credibility of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Distinctive in its strong evangelistic and apologetic foundation, the ministry of RZIM is intended to touch both the heart and the intellect of the thinkers and influencers of society through the support of the visionary leadership of Ravi. Our vision is to build a team with a fivefold thrust of evangelism, undergirded by apologetics, spiritual disciplines, because the person behind the apologetic, behind the evangel, has to be coherent, has to be have integrity. Those of you in the speakers program that we do, you know what I'm saying. If you don't have integrity as a person, forget the apologetic, forget the evangel, or the you know, the presentation there. And then training, the fourth part of the vision is training, to train those of us in this. And the fifth one is the humanitarian arm of RZIM, because apologetics needs to have a personal touch. It's too easy to get apologetics in the mind and always be on the cerebral level. And Ravi calls this apologetics with a touch, and it reflects his heart for the tender, for the poor, for the down and out. And it's a specific touch and a specific call to reach those who are at risk in their communities, specifically women and children. So he formed a ministry called Wellspring International that helps HIV orphans, that helps women and children from drug and sex trafficking, and all sorts of things. And so that's the backdrop of what this ministry is about. I want to tell you all this because I think it's important to give you an idea of the unique and expansive reach that Ravi has. In environments that few are able to speak in, few are asked to speak in, Ravi is a unique man for our times. And that's why the title of this is Ravi Zacharias, God's Man for Our Times. Very, very few people are being asked to do what he's being asked to do, and few people are able to do it. So I want to just kind of give you that feel and that flavor, whether it's speaking to Russian parliament or heads of state in the Middle East, where the Muslim domination is 99%, and that you could get killed if you weren't Muslim, the United Nations, etc. If you understand the breadth of his ministry and his life, then you can appreciate the story that we're going to go ahead and journey together with and go back to his roots. I'm going to read an awful lot today, do a lot of reading, so my job is easy. Hope you enjoy hearing people's stories, because the reason I'm going to read a lot, I want you to hear from his words himself. But I believe if you listen and you hear, you will find your story there too. That God might be calling you. I've actually been praying that God would be using the way that he spoke to Ravi and the way he wove his will into his life, that he would do the same in yours, that it might spark and prick your conscience, and it might minister to you tonight. So anyway, before we do that, I want to give you a little bit of this video. So are we going on? After this video, we'll go ahead and get started into Ravi's biography, but I want you to kind of see where he is now, and then give you an opportunity to appreciate where he's come from. Lit, man. Oh, lit, man. Can you pause it? All right. Did anybody feel anything in their gut listening to Ravi? I'm just curious. Nobody? Just me, huh? Nobody felt... Did anybody catch a little bit? Or it's just like, oh, that guy's interesting, white hair. Did anybody catch any vision or any heart? Did anyone catch anything? I just want to know. Ravi Zacharias International Ministries is doing unique things, amazing things that very few are doing. The SWAT program that he was talking about was an initiative started maybe about 10 years ago. It's called Scholars with a Dream. And what they did is they realized the oncoming onslaught of Islam. And they knew that the Christian is going to have to defend it and be able to defend the Christianity and be able to address the Islamic onslaught from a very, very deep understanding level. So they're working on developing 100 PhD scholars who would be majoring in doing their PhD work in Islam, so that they would be able to go on the inside and really know what's going on, really know how it is. And that's why Tanya Walker, he talked about the Sharia law. She's got an amazing story. Andy Bannister is another amazing product of that. And so this latest one is the one that we're going to have to do the same thing with the defense of the scriptures, because it's so easily being confused these days. We're trying to go deep with this. I want to share with you from where Ravi came, because obviously he sounds pretty brilliant, pretty learned, pretty amazing. But his story is really, really humble. And so I want to kind of give that to you and give you a background. I'm going to read a lot tonight, and I hope I can get this all in. But again, I wanted to speak to you. So let's pray and ask that the Lord, who is in our midst, would do something. I know He's going to do something. So I'm going to ask that you will respond to what He's doing. I have no doubt whatsoever that He's here. And that when He's here, He's not just sitting and just doing one of these things. He's actively knocking on some of your doors. He's knocking on some of your doors, and you guys are holding it back in like Romans 1 fashion, suppressing the truth because you don't want your life to change too much. And so you're holding it down as much. I'm going to ask Him to bowl you over so that He can break through. Heavenly Father, that's exactly what I'm asking for tonight. And I'm asking that you speak to us. And I'm asking, Lord, that you take the spiritual wax out of our ears. More importantly, that you remove the logs in our hearts and the stints that are there. Lord, help us to just stop playing around at Christianity, just saying, you know, we went to church and we did. I pray that you help us to be able to listen and receive the calling upon our lives, and that you might be moving and nudging us closer to what it is you have for us. As I know that you are present here clearly, but also lurking in the shadows, as you were with Robbie's life, I pray that you might illuminate what life is about, illuminate ways that you work, and give us encouragement, give us strength and hope tonight. And we pray that you would be glorified, and that we would be responsive. Because none of us, I can't speak for them. I don't want anybody here. I don't want a room full of people whose ears I'm tickling, who think they're here and doing a good work so they can go ahead and do their own life because they say they went to church. Lord, we know that, as Ravi said, this world is desperate, is desperately in need of credibility of the gospel in thought, in proclamation, and in living. And I pray that you would raise some people in this room to answer the call to the radical living that true Christianity takes, willing to give up dreams and willing to give up things of this world that every other person who's not even a Christian desires and wants, and that we just as Christian want it too, and we want to be Christian. Lord, radical living takes radical steps. You are radical. You did something absolutely radical in coming down from heaven to be with us. How radical is that, Lord? And I pray that you would help us to see that's that kind of obedience will take us places and will take you and your name farther and deeper. Raise us alive tonight, and I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. I'm going to start with just giving you a little clue to Ravi's personality. And the idea here isn't to highlight Ravi per se as much as to highlight the God of Ravi, but I want to give you some of the details of his life so that you can kind of just see how it is that God works. I'm going to give you a little clue to his personality and inner disposition. He begins the beginning of his biography, Walking from East to West, just talking about his homeland. And he goes home to India. He's sitting around and he's kind of describing the sights and the smells that he sees there. Here he says, "It's not for sentimental reasons that I visit this family in my uncle's former home." And here he is sitting in his former home. "They're simply more the beautiful people of my homeland with whom God has chosen than I crossed paths. The truth is that I am happiest when I'm with people such as these. People with whom I am at ease. Here in my homeland, I am most free to be me, with no one to recognize me because of my profession. And I get to do what I love best, simply to be with people. It reminds me of my youth when I surrounded myself with friends. But the reality is, in the next month, I will be speaking before the United Nations on the opening day of their assembly. I've been asked to address the ambassadors on the subject of navigating with absolutes in a relativistic world. The contrast between where I am now in this humble house and where I'm going to be in the matter of weeks are too vast to fully process. Yet there's no doubt that God prepared me for this life I now lead, connecting the varied and ironic threads of my experience into a beautiful tapestry as he would see fit. It is not the natural drive within me to appear in such a prominent place as the United Nations, and yet it is a privilege I hold dear and a sacred trust. But I never would have wanted to engineer something like this. That was my father's life. Because of the position to which he rose in the government of India, my siblings and I shook hands with prime ministers and presidents. We met and mixed with international leaders, and we even entertained ambassadors and their entourages. The wealthy and the powerful are one side of India, and yet I cannot explain why today I shrink from such public life. I can only say that it has to do with the way the Lord has framed me. I truly do feel for a world in need, and I relate with ease to the ordinary person." One thing that emerges about Ravi when you get to spend time with him in person or talk to him on the phone, as I've been able to do both, or listening to his messages, is the soft heart that he has for the young and the down and out. In fact, the first time we went to a Founders Weekend, this is back in the 90s, we had little Daniel was not even a year old yet, and then we came, and then when he saw us, he came, and then he prayed over Daniel, who happens to be Daniel Zacharias, by the way. And so Ravi's had a picture of Daniel on his desk for many years. And I remember after the way he prayed for Daniel, when Daniel was but a babe, when our eyes opened, Sandra's eyes were all wet in tears. I don't even know where she is. There you are. Sandra's eyes, you were over there a second. Sandra's eyes were in tears for this prayer that he offered for our son. Ravi is that way. It's the way he's built his team. It's the way he treats our kids. It's the reason why Wellspring International exists. Let me give you another little clue to this. At the same time, there's also evident on these streets the very resilience of the human spirit in the streets of India. People make a go of things with what they have. As I look from one side of the street to the other, I see those who will survive against all odds and who have learned to cope. India also is a deeply artistic culture. You see it even in this muddled up, mixed up mishmash of a marketplace, in the way a merchant hangs beads or arranges his cushions in a pleasing aesthetic. And each time I walk the streets of my homeland now, it's a matter of good news, bad news to me. The good news is I'm able to see clear-eyed here, to behold life and all its pain. The bad news is the pain is so overwhelming that I can get desensitized to it, and one has to be careful of that. That's why I keep telling my children to never forget from whence they ultimately came. As I walk my home street now, I am hit with the reality that my own life came out of nothing. By the time I was a teenager, when my family returned here on vacations to my mother's home in Chennai in the south, from our home in Delhi in northern India, I realized how small her family's house was. And how little my cousins had. I would ask my mother, "Why are they so poor?" By then,
coming to Chennai always reminded me of the meager side of our existence. Now, however, whenever I return, I have a yearning in my soul to be a solution to this. How can I help the very people whose blood is in my veins? Their food, their language, their ragtag existence from day to day, their struggle to survive, all of that is in me. So every time I come back, I always bring an envelope with money that I've saved up or I've set aside. And at the beginning of the week, that envelope is open to various needs. And by the time I leave, everything in it will be gone. In a little over a week from now, I will go home to a steady income and a comfortable home and, yes, a kind of sanitized life. But the ones I see struggling here, I know cannot make it on their own. So sharing with these people some of what I have and seeing a small bit of happiness it brings into their lives is a privilege of a native son. Anytime I read the accounts in the Gospels, I can envision the Lord with the lame man in all his bare need on the side of the road, or the leprous body longing for a touch. After all, that's what I saw growing up every day. And moreover, each time I read of the Lord walking in the streets of Bethany or Jerusalem and telling a parable, I see my Indian culture, which also deals in parables. And so now we're starting to get a little glimpse as to why Ravi's such a unique person and his adaptability and the lenses through which he sees. There are places that he goes because people can sense this understanding of culture, this understanding of East and West. It's an understanding that I think some of you may be able to develop. Some of you might have that ability to have that dual side of culture and that East-West uniqueness that someone such as myself, who is kind of, you know, I mean, I was born here, raised here, and everything I am is from here. And so you might be able to reach places that people like me can't. It's what makes him kind of unique for our times. Ravi was kind of growing up in a family that kind of had a mixed up religion, but really no religion at all. They were religious in the external senses. A lot of you, you know, have friends like that or maybe even grew up that way. But not really anything substantive on the inside. But here's his first experience with quote-unquote Christianity. I say that because it's not real Christianity. But here he says, "My siblings and I got our first taste of Western religion when two Jehovah's Witnesses came knocking on our door one day. A Mr. and Mrs. Smith appeared, telling my father that they wanted to teach us children to read and to know the Bible. So they assured our dad how very important this was to us. So the Smiths came to our home once a week, and for the next year and a half, they sat in our living room and taught us for an hour or two at a time. I remember reading the Witnesses' book, Let God Be True, in the magazines of Watchtower and Awake. Most impressive, though, were the assemblies that they gathered groups and showed movies. And one of these movies featured tens of thousands of people attending a Jehovah's Witness rally in Yankee Stadium in New York City. When my siblings and I saw that spectacle, we couldn't help but be awed by it. And yet in retrospect, it shows how easily the human mind and heart can be manipulated. Ours was a small family with very little in comparison to most families in the West. And seeing that movie with all those highly successful looking people gathered in a magnificent stadium, my siblings' hearts must have raced as my heart did. I'm sure they also thought, this has to be true. It made us want to be part of such a great event in a great city like New York. So we continued to study with the Smiths until the day Mr. Smith came to the chapter on heaven in the book of Revelation. He stopped there and he told us that according to Jehovah's Witnesses' teaching, only 144,000 people were going to make it to paradise. That hit me like a ton of bricks. Here my siblings and I had thought we were becoming very spiritual. These Western missionaries had sat with us each week, giving us homework and encouraging our studies. But now I scratch my head over this news. And so I asked Mr. Smith, only 144,000? That's right, he said. How many people are there in your organization? Oh, we have many. Do you have more than 144,000? Yes. So, even all of your people are not going to make it to heaven. I thought of the Smiths' constant praying, of all their efforts to reach more and more people. And yet even they had no way of knowing where they were going after death. So they certainly couldn't assure me of where I might be going. Mr. Smith, before you came, I didn't know where I was going after I died, I said. But now, after all this study, I still don't know where I'm going after I die. They probably sensed they were up against something difficult at that point. Or perhaps my outright shock over this curious point of doctrine registered with them more deeply than normal. But not long afterwards, the Smiths were succeeded by another couple, and when they sensed they were getting nowhere, they stopped coming to our house. Who knows? In another 6 or 8 months, maybe we would have been convinced by them. But at that stage, I told myself, I don't much care for this. I'm done with Christianity. Now, I didn't know that it wasn't Christianity I was rejecting, but I really had no idea how to distinguish one sect from another. At best, each of us was only thinking pragmatically. What is it that's going to work for me? Another part of Ravi's background, I don't know if you picked up, and I'm sure you did, but Ravi has a way with words. Did any of you pick that up? There's a way with language. Ravi loves language. He loves the way language sounds. He loves different languages. He loves reading books. He loves reading billboards. Books is just now, by the way. He hated books when he was growing up. But he loves the way it rolls off the tongue. He's told us that in Founders of different ways where when he gets into a bookstore, he starts getting nervous of anticipation because he gets into the bookstore and he says sometimes he has to start going to the bathroom. He's so excited. He's just right now, he's just, a bookstore is like the place that, you know, just as the dog does his tail wagging, he says he just gets a little shivery. He just loves books now. But in his background is a good lesson for us, because in his background is a family, a line of people who were able to articulate, people good with language. And why that's important is what it is that we are passionate about will rub off on the next generations. What is it that you're passionate about? What is it that people know and recognize you are enthused about? That will rub off on those you lead and those who follow you. So when you talk to Ravi, it's quite different than talking to a normal Westerner. There's thought. There's intention. There's a bit of cleverness and wit every time we talk. I remember one time, he was telling me how Maya Angelou's getting bigger and growing up, and I said, "Yeah, boy, she keeps us on our toes." And he goes, "Yeah, and I bet on your knees too." And I said, "You know, you're right." And you know, he's just very much able to turn the phrase, not just in a memorized way, but able to think intricately. There is a sense that you know that he's listening to you and that his mind is working. And I'm just giving this to you because there's some things that draw people in, and it may be something that you can kind of acclimate yourself to if it's good. And I find the same thing with language. I find it in Coach Wooden. I find it with Johnny Erickson Tata. I find it with John R.C. I find the same thing with this intention and this cleverness, this thought, this interest in your life. I mean, even when Ravi signs a book or sends you a book, it's not generic but proportionate to your relationship with him. Coach Wooden is the same way. And I've seen them sign books to acquaintances or strangers, and you know, they're gracious and warm, but general, you know, best wishes, John Wooden, best wishes, Ravi Zacharias, or whatever. And so, you know, today what I did is I went to all my signed books from Ravi, just kind of looked at all of them at different stages. And what I noticed was that in the beginning years of when we just kind of started to get to know him, they would say, "With appreciation, with gratitude, Ravi," you know. As our relationship with him kind of grew over the years and we were around longer and more, and then I noticed they started beginning to say with the ensuing books, "With my love and appreciation," or "Love you all," you know, "To the wonderful Shia family, with my love and affection." And in a simple signing, or even a signing off on a letter, you know, that he would write to us. I wish I didn't even bring it. I wish I brought the 50th birthday message that he gave to Sandra on video, and you could see just, you know, rejoicing. But even in signing off on a letter, there's a warmth and a tenderness that can be artfully communicated, which is something we can learn. In his emails to me, he always signs off with trying to encourage and express personal warmth. Blessings, dear friend, and my love to the family. And what I'm really trying to illustrate here is that every time he is communicating with you, he's trying to impart the warmth of Christ to you, even in something as simple as a sign-off. And what it shows is it shows an effort and an understanding that you're dealing with a person. Because I dislike cold, matter-of-fact emails that contain no warmth. Just written to a position, not a person, to get something done, rather than understanding there's always a relationship with the person who's you're emailing with. And so he tries to give you as much love and warmth as he's legitimately able to do. And what I mean by that is within the reality of the relationship that he has with you, he tries to bring that to the max. Now, Johnny does the same thing. If he's overspoken and he signed off more warmly than your relationship, then you would know it would be insincere. But he doesn't do less either. And I've got lots of signed books by lots of authors, you know, and I've no different. And you can kind of get a feel from different ones. And some people who kind of think they're all that, you know, and so they kind of sign with it. And then some who really think it's a privilege that you own their book, and is, you know, and that's how Ravi is. He seizes the opportunity to try to bring Christ to you, and he's humbled by the opportunity to do so. Now, there's another Christian celebrity that I know of who writes "Love You" on every book that he writes, whether he knows you or not. And there's a legitimate way you can do that within common grace, you know, just a general way that "I love you" in the name of Christ or something, or in Him or something like that. But you can't go past that, and if you really take it more than that, then it's not really sincere, right? You know, I thought of Eunice, actually, because, you know, as an example, too, here, because Eunice is particularly good at conveying love and thought, even down to her sign-offs, so, which are always tender and always thought through, even down to the very last word. And you get the feeling of, or at least I do when she emails or texts me, is that she's trying to send as much love as she possibly can right down to the very last letters of her texts and emails, as each word is thoughtfully chosen. And why do I bring this up? I tell you this about language and things because I ask you to pay attention to words and phrasing, verbal, written, or otherwise, to hone your mastery of language. I ask you to do that because Christianity is caught, but it's also taught. And it's a conveyed gospel. It's something that is propositional. It comes through words, and God could have done it any way He wants, but He chose the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Jesus decided to come as the Word. So the Word has power, and there's if it's the way that we are to communicate, we need to pay attention and keep honing our craft. Because words are your craft. And those future teachers out there, of you who will be teachers, words are your craft. And so love people enough to try to learn how to use language in a way that might be able to elicit something that, you know, just mere throwing it to them in a very basic and pragmatic form would do. What you'll find with Robbie, he loves food. He's such a foodie. But part of it, he likes the presentation. He likes the way. He likes the sauces. He likes the nuances. And that's exactly how he serves his verbal meals. Instead of just slopping it on, making a big piece of meat, bam, on your plate, and giving you the meat of which, you know, you could say, "I gave it to you," and he did, you know. And some people just serve it that way. He likes it done finally with intention. He likes with a little surprise element, with a little something in there that would make you go, aha. I'm not going to read this part to you, but even he was actually trained in the culinary arts, and he's, you know, actually quite a cook and chef. And one year he was at a big camp, and he was at a camp, but not as the speaker, as the chef. And so they gave him the items, and he had no idea what coleslaw and macaroni and cheese from India, you know, what all this was. So he instead just saw the stuff, and so he whipped up and did French meals because he was trained in French cuisine. And so that camp was the most unique food anyone's ever had at regular camp food. And he's, you know, drawing up and drawing the sauces and making the unique fare. That's, you can tell,
is what he likes, and that's how he thinks that words end in the meal that he's giving you is worth the attention to detail, that the gospel that he's sharing is worth that kind of attention, even for the little extra special touches. And that's what I appreciate about him. One of the other things I appreciate about him. Something I learned from R.C. Sproul in the 90s, early 90s, way back then, is this. He spoke of what they did is they did extensive research across all professions, from athlete to surgeon and everything in between. And what they were doing was trying to find out, and they not only did research across all professions, but they located and interviewed the top people in every profession, trying to find what common ground there is in the top people, what commonality there is to find in the top of all the professions. And what they found was the mastery of language. So it didn't matter what profession they were in, even if it had nothing to do with language, maybe it's your hands or something. They found that language, mastery of language, was the common thing that of all the people at the top. The ability to communicate. And so that's one thing we really, really, really need to guard ourselves from in our emailing, our texting, our Twittering, our Facebooking, and that is the erosion of language. Ravi would line up 100% behind me in this. I'm quite sure that he will line up just right alongside me in this. Because erosion of language, what will happen when we do our little fragmented sentence and just bare minimum getting you a message and little quick twit to you and, you know, twit to a twit for some, in some reasons, in some instances. What will happen is that the erosion of language will be accompanied by an erosion of beauty. And the fine nuances and the extras that take something from the practical and the functional to the sublime will be lost. Like that fine meal that I told you about, exquisitely and artfully prepared, or in music or in art. It takes us beyond the common, beyond the normal, beyond the mundane, and points us to the art of our beautiful God. Both as seen in creation, in the art out there, but also in the beauty of the moral law within, in here. And so, I want you to just make note of that, because if language can be eroded to just be very functional and kind of blah, 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 ha, ha, you know, and just without any thought, then you're taking away some of what God's beauty is. It's another way to go ahead and make everything like oatmeal or porridge, just blah, in the middle. And, you know, it says God will supply our needs according to his riches, in proportionate to the magnitude and the refraction of the billion colors. The reason why there are 256 million colors in your color palette on the computer is because that's all the little nuances that God actually is. And if we just start bringing it down to its minimum functional level, we're going to lose a lot of the beauty of God. And then people aren't really captured and captivated just by the minimum. But only God can really bring you to the maximum. And he's the only one we can really point to that goes beyond the minimum. So there is an effort afoot, and I think Satan's right up behind it, to bring us down to that minimum level, the minimum common denominator. I'm saying, people, let's be on guard against that. Another thing in his background I got to tell you about is Ravi comes from a very accomplished family. And this is important in the story. Ravi has a distinguished gene pool, as it were. A father that ascended to high government ranks. Here, let me just read this just to give you a little flavor. And this is important in the story. My father's side of the family certainly had its share of brain power. They came from what can only be described as the upper echelon of Indian society. My father's brother-in-law, my uncle, was a prominent pharmacologist who wrote a well-known textbook used for decades in India's medical schools. His grandfather and his great-grandfather were also the authors of a famed dictionary, the very first of its kind, an Anglo-Malayalam dictionary, and they're very renowned. The distinguished gene pool often showed in his attitude and his self-confidence, and sadly, many times in his disposition to those not from such privileged roots.
My dad applied his intellect to studies in industrial labor relations at Nottingham University in England. And sometime after he returned to India, the government transferred him from Madras in the south to Delhi in the north. So my family bid goodbye to the southern life and became, in effect, northerners in our tongue and culture. I was quite young at the time, probably around 4 or 5, and we lived in Delhi until I was 20. But during that period, my father ascended government ranks to hold a very powerful portfolio as deputy secretary in the State Department, which in India is called the Home Ministry. I want you to get a better understanding of the East, just to see where he came from. It's somewhat funny that when I am given any introduction in India at a speaking event, what is said of me depends on where I'm being introduced. If I'm being introduced in Delhi, I'm introduced as a native son. If I'm in Chennai, I'm said to be a child of Chennai's soil. In Kerala, I'm described as the product of Keralite blood. All these things are very important there, and I am happy to cater to each setting, appreciative of all the many teary-eyed elderly persons who want to come and stroke my face when I'm finished, each endearingly laying claim to my roots. Most people I have met who have grown up in a Western culture don't seem to be nearly as aware of their ancestry as those from the East. I have lived in North America for almost 40 years now, and I've experienced the differences between cultures. In Western culture, we are so pragmatically and entrepreneurially driven that we tend to overlook the lines throughout history that have fallen into place for us to arrive at where we are today. We think it just happened. It hasn't. And those from Eastern cultures never forget that. They always know their ancestry. I remember such a moment when I was still in my 20s, and for the first time, I had returned to India to preach. My wife and I were honored guests at a very prestigious cricket club where I was to speak, and the introduction caught Margie completely off guard. To begin with, the introduction was about 10 minutes long, and beyond that, it was entirely about my father. And in typical Eastern fashion, no part of his credits and accomplishments was left unembellished. Finally, after a pause, the hostess said, "And now we will hear from his son." I understood what was happening, and I smiled, also understanding what was behind the stunned look of my wife's face. I knew what she was thinking. What? Couldn't you say anything about Ravi? His father's not even here. But in their minds, they had said something about me. What greater compliment could they give to me than that I was the son of my father? Again, I want you to take advantage of your opportunities that you have. As Asian Americans, as you have the Asian part, you have the American part. Don't take the worst of each. Take the best of each and allow it to propel you into something where your fellow classmates will be able to see there's something better about them. There's something more noble. What is it? And because God is working in both sides of the ocean. One of the most emphasized lessons I learned from listening all around and observing was that you had to succeed professionally. This ought to ring a bell with you guys. Keep your private heartache private. Keep your collapsing world propped up. Professional appearances are all you can take with you, and one dare not wash the family dirty linen in public. I could understand that to a degree, but it left a residual heartache in private. That's what life is all about. Become a doctor, become a lawyer, become a military officer, become part of society's influential lot. This was passed along to each of us, both explicitly and implicitly. So in this sense, my oldest brother, Ajit, was the mirror image of my dad. He was confident, poised, and I wanted to be so much like him. Ajit was very sharp and professionally driven, like our father. And I think that's why the two of them got along very well. My dad apparently saw Ajit as the one who was going to carry the family's accolades. And to this day, we each see my dad differently. And then there was my two sisters, Prem and Shem, who were gifted in music and in many other qualities that I didn't have. And my little brother, of course, was the darling of the family, being the youngest. That's me, by the way. Somewhere in the middle, Ravi says, was me. My dad was very affirming toward my siblings. Not to the degree that a typical father would have been, but he did affirm them. He always affirmed Ajit. In fact, my brother and father were so much alike that on rare occasions they butted heads. And when they did, my heart would beat faster as I watched Ajit stand his ground, which is something I never could have done myself. My dad knew that Ajit was a toe-to-toe kind of person like himself, and he couldn't be pushed too far. On one occasion, when we were all on the dining room table for dinner, my dad did something that upset Ajit. My brother said something in response, and there followed a very long, tense moment. I shivered in my shoes. I didn't know what would happen. And after a tense moment between them that seemed like an eternity, each staring each other down, my dad backed down, and the tension slowly deflated the silence. My dad knew he was up against his own kind. Our father had very endearing terms for my sisters and my younger brother, and he had a very affectionate way with them and with the other children. And other children, for that matter. But for whatever reason, he had no such term of endearment for me. He just always called me by my name. And that was a small thing compared to knowing that I was also the one consistently on the receiving end of his rather violent temper. I never could figure out why his wrath was reserved for me in ways that carried over even into my middle teens. None of the rest of our family have ever understood it either. Maybe I cowered in his presence and it was just his nature to go for the weak one. I was certainly the weakest of the bunch. Whatever it was, something developed in which I became the brunt of all his anger. My brothers and sisters knew it. My mother certainly knew it. Even Margie came to know it in our married years from the stories that were told and by the way I held myself in my father's presence, even as an adult. I often wondered if it was because my dad didn't even see me until more than after a year after I was born. He was in England studying at Nottingham when my mother gave birth to me, and he didn't return till well after I was 1 year old. That may or may not have had some bearing on the tension that I always felt from him. As soon as he came home from work each night, my whole demeanor would change. If he and I were alone in a room, I would find an excuse to leave and get something. I'm sure it was not all his fault. I feared him and therefore could not make conversation. As time went on, his fears of my failure and my fear of him met in some very painful memories. I simply never performed at the level my siblings did. My life seemed purposeless, without direction. I could never live up to his expectations, nor could I bridge the distance that existed between us. It was an impasse neither of us was able to solve on our own. When it came to academics in school for Ravi, it was always tough. Ravi barely squeaked through each level or grade. He says, at times I was punished severely at both at home and at school. Ravi was put in the class at Delhi Public School with the worst students. They had a class where the worst students were. And he says, from my earliest days, there were signs in my life that I just lacked the disciplines of study. I never adapted to a routine, and of course, that was not a good thing in a highly competitive culture like India's. I know if I had worked hard, I would not have suffered as much as I did. I continually pushed the lines, although never in the realm of immorality. But I was irresponsible. In Delhi Public School, corporal punishment was very severe. When I was 9 or so, my teacher in the 3rd standard, Mrs. Nelson, was as tough as they came. The school's worst students were always placed in her class because she had a reputation for straightening them out. I was one of her students. And one day when I came to class, I hadn't done my homework as usual. She decided to make me sit on the bare dirt outside of the tent during class. Then during lunch hour, I had to stay there on the ground, humiliated, doing my homework as my classmates walked by me enjoying their lunch. The next day, I hadn't done my homework again, and this time Mrs. Nelson called me to the front of the class. When she asked me where my homework was, I told her I'd forgotten it. I suddenly remembered that Mrs. Nelson had a reputation for slapping a student's face until his ears rang. And at that moment, I thought I saw her rearing back to do just that. So I braced myself, tilting my head to the right. But unknown to me, my teacher was left-handed, and her palm came up with lightning speed and a thunderous force against the side of my face. She slapped me a couple times so hard that my head rang and my body trembled. It was punishing in force and in embarrassment. The next time that happens, she warned, you'll be in the principal's office and you'll get the cane. Thankfully, I never let it go that far, but Mrs. Nelson's name and ferocity remain ever in my memory. A few months ago, I was sitting in a plane heading to Dallas when an Indian gentleman sat next to me. We got to talking, and to our utter surprise, we found out that we had both gone to Delhi Public School in our school days. Were you ever in Mrs. Nelson's class, he asked. Somewhat embarrassed, I said, I'm afraid so. So was I, he said. He reached out his hand, and he shook mine and said, Congrats, we both made it. Ravi says that God alone knows how to humble us without humiliating us, and how to lift us up without flattering us. God alone knows how to humble us without humiliating us, and how to lift us up without flattering us. Like me in my mind, actually I identify with Ravi a lot. Ravi turned to sports for his identity and focus. And kind of like me, Ravi was a prankster. I mean, he was more so than I was, but just for mischievous fun and to compensate for insecurity and purposelessness in his life. Let me just read to you a little bit. Once at summer camp, we met a guy named Eugene, whose nickname was Turkey. Turkey foolishly admitted to the rest of us that he was scared of the dark. And as soon as he said this, I saw a look register on my friends' faces that seemed to say, uh-oh, Turkey made a mistake by saying that. He should never have admitted that in front of Ravi. I asked Turkey, why do you get afraid? Unexplained noises, he said. That was another bad confession. Somehow that afternoon, I found the time to sneak away and implement my scheme. I tied some tin cans together onto a long string, and then I draped the string through the ventilation opening that ran from Turkey's room to ours. So that night, well after lights out, I tugged at the string pretty gently at periodic intervals. We all heard Turkey climb out of bed and start pacing the floor. Every 10 minutes or so, I would give it another yank, and Turkey would get up again. We could tell he was looking around, trying to find out where the noises were coming from, but with no success. The next morning, one look at Turkey's face told us that he hadn't slept a wink. And that was mean, but for my youthful sense of identity, it was successful. Today, it troubles me a bit to think that such things gave me a laugh. I found one prank to be particularly advantageous. I must confess it was not a good one. I pretended to be a go-between for any fellow and any girl who were trying to establish a friendship. I loved pastries, and so I would tell the guy, you know, she really loves cakes. And then he would bring cakes to me, and he would bring cakes to me to pass on to the girl. But of course, half of them never made it to her. Or I would pretend to one of them that the other was in the next room. And I would say to the girl, what do you want him to know? I'll give him your message. And I would step into the next room, which of course was totally empty. And then I would come back with a fake message from him. And then I'd pull the charade on the fellow. My sisters still talk about what a dirty trick this was. And to understand this, you really need to know how our culture separated the genders so as to limit any romantic involvements. So time spent with a member of the opposite gender alone was non-existent. We had to find ways and means of something to entertain the fancy, even if it meant just sending a pastry to the other. When the day came that I had to disclose this whole thing as a farce, the two didn't know whether to choke me or to say, how did we really get taken in like that? Again, I must say I feel pretty bad about this now because I exploited people. But at the time, I thought of it as merely a short-term prank that would not hurt anyone too much. One of the benefits resulting from another of our pranks, and on this my friends and I all agreed, was that no one in India attended more wedding dinners than we did. In northern India, weddings begin with the bridegroom riding on horseback to the bride's house. Any of you who know Indian weddings know this. He is followed by what's called the bridegroom's party, a company of up to three or four hundred people. Musicians playing, women waving lanterns, others happily taking part in the celebration. So when the bridegroom's party arrives at the bride's house, they are welcomed in for a brief ceremony. Then all of the bridegroom's guests are seated and served a royal dinner. The bride's guests are served the second round. As for the menu, it consists of the best chicken, rice, and curry dishes that you've ever tasted. India's delicacy is tandoori chicken. Chicken that has been marinated overnight in spices and saffron in a yogurt base, then put on a skewer and barbecued in a clay oven. You talk about succulent, mouth-watering food. We couldn't afford it very often, but it was served at every wedding if the menu was non-vegetarian. Now, because these weddings can be so large, sometimes up to 1,500 or 2,000 people, it's easy to get lost in the crowd. So my cricket mates, you know, he plays cricket, he was quite an athlete, and I found this to be very advantageous indeed. In fact, we relied on it to secure probably a significant number of the best wedding dinners in Delhi over the course of any given summer. Sometime around late April or May, the wedding season begins, and about 6:30 every evening, you would hear a band playing in the distance and see a procession coming down the road. Calling it a band is very generous. The instruments were probably left over some prehistoric collection, and out-of-tune sounds made for grimaces as we listened. Oh, but what an omen it was to hear a band playing in the distance, getting closer by the minute. That was our signal for us to drop our cricket bats, to rush to our buddy's house where we had made sure to bring our dress shoes beforehand, change out of our cricket shoes and our shirts, and casually join in the procession. If you're going to be part of the bridegroom's party, it's important that you congratulate him heartily and cheer him on. And so with this rule, we gladly complied, waving happily and calling out the lucky fellow's name once we earned it. However, there were some risks, and since we were never just in typical wedding attire, we needed a plan in case a waiter came to be suspicious and started giving us the eye. So when that happened, one of us would say to another, purposely with an earshot of the waiter, "What time's your father coming?" This usually gave the waiter reason to pause, because he would not want to offend a legitimate guest whose father was about to appear. It was also the signal for one of us to look at the waiter and order with great confidence, "What are you standing there for? Get us some cashews." This would cause the waiter further hesitancy, we thought, as he would reason that we must belong there, otherwise we wouldn't be ordering him around. So after these wedding dinner outings, we'd usually get home around 8 o'clock, just as my mother was serving dinner. I'd walk in and I'd say I wasn't really hungry that night. That in itself would be a shock to the servants. My mother would ask, "You're not having dinner?" "No, Mom, I'm not that hungry." "Have you been eating at weddings again?" In utter frustration, she would ask me, "Robbie, why do you keep doing this?" "Mom," I assured her calmly, "all wedding invitations say we invite you along with your family and friends." "Well, there's always a distinct possibility that I might have a friend there somewhere." And then I would pause and I would say to my brothers and sisters, "Boy, you really should have tasted that tandoori chicken." I won't read the one that almost cost him his life, the prank, and cost the. But you kind of get the idea. I'm just kind of wanting to give you this background, and our time is running, but it's important. And then I'm going to really zip on along ahead. India prides itself on being a highly moral culture. So I knew early on that there was a moral framework through which I had to look at life. And yet I didn't know the why behind that framework. To me, it was merely pragmatic. You just don't hurt people, you don't use them, you don't abuse them. And thus I knew from the very beginning that the way my dad handled his relationship with my mother was wrong. At the same time, I knew things weren't adding up in my own life. I don't recall connecting this to any kind of moral failure on my part, and if I did, it must have been trumped in my mind by what I saw as a matter of survival. My father's beratings continued, and yet now they came more frequently as I got older at the age of adult responsibility. "Why are you such a failure?" he would begin. And this didn't come as a question, but a character statement. "If I could help you, if you succeeded only," he said, "I could help you if you succeeded only this much," holding up his finger and his thumb. "I could make a phone call and get you somewhere." I never felt this was an offer so much as a condemnation. He knew correctly that I would never be admitted to a university with the grades that I was making. So he saw community college as my only hope for salvaging a future. Hence, I was enrolled at 16, a year earlier than most students, to begin my shortcut to a university degree. Yet this would even short-circuit before long. The grading in India is very different from the United States. You simply don't score in the 80s or 90s. 40 was a pass, 60 was a pass with distinction. And despite my father's plans for me and his efforts on my behalf, my undisciplined study habits continued as they had. If I needed a 40% to pass, I would just barely get it and let it go at that. In some ways, I didn't know how to study. No one ever taught me. On the other hand, learning was not an innate skill for me, and I wasn't very retentive. Yet it wasn't just my passionate dislike for school that drove me away from studies. It was the depths of my emptiness welling up within me. Deep down, I knew there was no longer anywhere to turn for answers. I didn't even know if the answers to my deepest hungers actually existed. Life had simply stopped making any sense. And that frustration and hopelessness drove me with even more determination to the cricket field. It was the only place I could find that offered any kind of hope or reason to exist. I began skipping my classes regularly, wandering the streets on my bicycle in search of a cricket match that I could watch or partake in. And soon I was absent for every class I was taking. I showed up for only exams and barely squeaked by. I was on a collision course. So one day after cycling home, I turned into our backyard as usual, only to find my father standing in the doorway. He wasn't normally home at that hour, and the sight of him there startled me. He stood with his arms stretched across the open doorway as if to block my entry into the house. "Hi, Dad." as I said, as innocuously as I could, as I parked my bike against the neem tree in our backyard, I felt his glare bearing down on me. "How was school?" he asked, and a terror rose in my heart. He had never asked me such a question before. His interest surprised me. Fine, I answered as I approached the door. I tried to act as normally as I would, but I couldn't help trembling as I got within his reach. He would not move to allow me to enter the house. I was face to face with him now, as uncomfortable as I had ever been in my life, and the moment of truth had come. There's a lesson in life I always tell TD, and please remember, the bill always comes due. In an instant, it dawned on me that my report card must have arrived. Ah, the absences! He literally grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and dragged me into the house, and the torrent of anger my father unleashed on me was like none before. The beating began, the hits and the kicks were descending in unmitigated wrath. In the beginning, I raised my hands instinctively to protect myself, but it did no good. Soon I had turned and I was crouching and taking his blows on my back, and with each attempted answer I gave to his raging questions, another hit followed. Once he got going, he didn't know when to stop. I knew I could no longer do anything against him, and I crumpled to my knees. "Enough!" a voice cried. "Please stop! Please stop!" It was my mother. She came between us, and my father relented while trembling and breathless with rage. He was also asthmatic and was now wheezing heavily. I could hear him in his heavy breath. As I felt my mother's comforting warmth over me, it was as if a violent storm had ended, leaving devastation behind. And yet I remember sobbing and not being able to stop. Some of this is still a blur to me, except I know that my mother came in the way of the beating and brought it to an end. I don't remember when my father had stopped, nor do I remember how badly my mother suffered herself. I only know this, that if she had not stepped in, he would have done serious damage to me. Even just telling this story now in written form has been very painful. That night I stood punished and facing a wall, a fitting metaphor of my life. My charade was over, but that had done nothing to free me. I was more imprisoned than ever by the pressing struggles within me. My father's thrashing had never worked. They only increased my malaise. Yet a terrible truth had begun to dawn on me. I knew that in this one area of my life, he was at least partly right. I have never taken my studies seriously, and therefore there was no future for me. I seemed destined to be an academic vagabond. I was one among our band of friends who had the least promise of the future. Sundar was obviously headed for a great academic career. He had been accepted to the prestigious Indian Institute of Technology on the outskirts of Delhi. My other friends on our cricket team had all had something which they were really good at. But cricket was all I had. And all I could imagine for myself was a professional career in the sport. And I wanted very seriously to play, not taking into consideration how tough it would be to make the lineup. And what I didn't consider as well was that the professional players at that time did not make a living at their sports. Their primary profession was some other area. Some worked for rail lines, others for firms that allowed them time off to play professional matches. My dad obviously knew this, and if he suspected that I had any such aspirations, he would have known it was no way for me to make a living. And now more than ever, his haunting summation of my life came back to me. "You will never make anything of yourself." And now I was convinced he was right. That's probably why I never held it against him. I wasn't doing well, and I wasn't making it. Why should I expect to have a future? And still his words carried a heavy double-edged blow. First, he was right. And second, this was all he had to say to me. He had nothing else to offer. And I don't blame my father for my failures up to that point in my life, but I do believe he made a mistake. I'm a father myself, and I believe my dad should have taken me aside to talk. As best as he was able, he should have said, "Son, sit down. I need to speak with you. Tell me what's going on inside of you. Why are you living this lie? Why are you doing this to yourself? Where is it that you want to go in life? How can I help get you there?" I was a source of shame for him, but the fact remains that he extended no genuine help to me, nor was there any offer of hope, and that was a heartbreaker. I'm just going to skip here through just a little bit because it comes to a head. I'm just giving you snippets. The book tells you much more in depth and much further. You can feel Ravi's life. You can feel the dad. You can feel the family. But I'm going to skip to a point, a very poignant point. Who am I and what am I doing? I've been asking myself these questions relentlessly, day after day. If you have the idea that life is something random, that there is no point to it, no purpose, that you just happen to be there in existential terms, that you are a useless being floating on a sea of nothingness, for whom in the end it all comes to nothing, then the idea of becoming nothing can seem better than that random something. It was the French existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre who said, "I've asked myself many questions and have answered all of them. The only question I cannot answer is why I don't commit suicide." I'd heard some of my classmates speak on the unspeakable, of the unspeakable on several occasions. The word suicide was whispered, sometimes in jest, at other times mockingly, but we knew there was really no humor or sarcasm intended, especially as failure always seemed imminent. And yet they had no more reason to consider this than I. Why put my family through any more of this, I thought. My father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters. And I don't know exactly when I came to the decision, but when I did, I made it firmly and calmly. A quiet exit will save my family any further shame, and it will spare me any further failure. Was I depressed when I made my decision? No. Was it impulsive? No. I'd seen it coming for some time, perhaps always lurking in my mind as the final escape. Some cultures lend themselves more to thought than others. My culture was definitely one of them. More to the thought of suicide than others. When I arrived at the university that morning, I walked into the chemistry lab. No one was there. I did not hesitate in my mission. Somehow I got into the locked cupboard where the chemicals were, and I poured over shelf after shelf until I came to some packets marked poison. I grabbed several of them and stuffed them into my pockets. I went directly home from the college and hid the bag in which I had put the packets. I had no idea what the chemicals were. They might have been some kind of acid, for all I knew, which could have burned through my insides. As far as I recall, that evening I played my usual game of cricket. What loomed in my mind, however, was foolish, very foolish, a coward's exit, really, but I had made my decision. The next morning, one by one, each family member left for school or work. My mother, curious, asked me why I was still home. I just brushed her question aside, telling her the classes were at the beginning later in that day. With the house emptied of my family, I went to the kitchen for a glass of water. It helped me to drink down the poison. The rest of it goes, and if I had the time, I would read more as to... But he did. He drank it, immediately spit it up, called out. Person came, and then he's in a hospital bed. And when he comes to, his mom is there sitting in his side. And when his mom is sitting there in his side, I wondered what had happened to the plastic packets of poison I'd emptied. Did the servant try to protect me from my father and throw them out so that it wouldn't look like a suicide attempt, but just a sudden gastrointestinal attack of some sort? He did something, for sure, to cover my tracks. 2 or 3 days passed before I began to feel any strength at all coming back. My friends were not allowed to visit because I was so ill, but they wouldn't have known what had happened. No one had told them why I was in the hospital. I was sure that only my mother and perhaps my father knew what had happened. A day or so later, a man named Fred David came to visit. He was one of the directors of Youth for Christ, whose rally I had attended with my sister. I was in no shape to talk as he stood over my bed, so he turned to my mother and he handed her a Bible. "I brought this for you," he said, opening the book. He flipped through the pages until he came to a certain spot. "Here," he said, pointing to a spot on the page and showing it to my mother. "This is for Ravi." They talked for a while as I drifted in and out. I was uncomfortable with any visitors, but I was glad Fred was there. His presence seemed to bring my mother some reassurance. Once he left, my mom decided to read the passage to me. "He brought this for you," she said, showing me the Bible. She opened it to the 14th chapter of John's Gospel. It told of Jesus in conversation with the Apostle Thomas. She looked down the page and began with this sentence, "Because I live, you also will live." The words hit me like a ton of bricks. "Live? Mom," I interjected, "please read it again." This life sounded very different from ordinary life. I had no real idea what it all meant and no idea of the context of the words. All I knew was that it spoke something of something beyond what I had experienced. So she read the verse again. "Who is that speaking?" I asked. Later I found out the words were those of Jesus as he spoke to his disciples. He was responding to Thomas's question about where Jesus was going. I didn't know the full ramifications of the verse, but to me, Christ's words in John chapter 14, verse 19 were the defining paradigm. "Because I live, you also will live." This may be my only hope, I thought, a new way of living. Life as defined by the author of life. "Jesus," I prayed inwardly, "if you are the one who gives life as it is meant to be, I want it. Please get me out of this hospital bed well, and I promise I will leave no stone unturned in my pursuit of truth." It was a simple, pragmatic prayer, and yet it would have immense ramifications. What you need to know is that after that moment, Ravi was a new man. And that really shouldn't be a surprise for us, should it? A new man. Because that's what being a Christian is. A new person. That's what it means to be born again. That's what it means to be different from what your biological background, culture, and makeup says you should be. I would read the rest, a certain portion to you of why it needs, but I don't have time. But what Ravi was explaining in there is that in India, the certain culture and the background and all the lines of history, you're pretty much locked into who you are. You're from this caste, you're from this family, you're from this, and that's who you are. They know who you are, and you're pretty much in that caste for life. But he's saying, what does it mean to be born again? If in the flesh your family had this going on and that going on, and that's why you... What does it mean that you need a new birth? No wonder it's so difficult for the Easterner to come to Christ. Because that means you're leaving your old. Everything's old. And when Jesus says, you are a new creation, the old is gone, the new has come, what that does now is speak to a new birth, a new heart, a new soul, a new paradigm, a new proclivity, a new desire, And so what Ravi shares is that not only did his actions change, but what he wanted to do changed. A new birth means new spiritual DNA, a new direction. The old is gone, the new has come. That's why you get a new direction. That's why you get new desires. That's why I'm not the person I used to be before I was a Christian. I'm so different. So different. Going in a different direction. And that's why the gifts, you know, God gives you talents and abilities at your physical birth, which you still have because you're in the body. But when your spiritual birth arrives, He gives you new spiritual ones that may be totally different from your original physical ones. Totally. And this speaking in front of you and speaking in front of audiences is not something that was natural to me. Never, 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 never. This only comes about in the new birth for me. Maybe some had it already, but I never did. And Ravi's life changed. His life was new. He had a new spirit, a new birth, a new direction, new spiritual gifts. You know, like RC, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, this once uninterested, flunking student who hated reading now began to read voraciously. RC, remember, read the entire Bible in a matter of weeks. He hated reading, but he read the Bible in weeks after his conversion. Ravi devoured, a few days after he became a Christian, he devoured an entire commentary that he found on a trash heap on the book of Romans. And in days he finished it. And he kept reading and reading. He began with Christian biographies, which is not a bad place to start. He says, as I read about these inspiring lives, the old adage came true for me. Fire begets fire. That's why he loved reading biographies, because the fire in them begets, you know, what it does is it begets, it births fire within you. Anything I could lay my hands on, he says, with the gospel message, I read. And then he started reading English authors. First, the Oxford Don and apologist C.S. Lewis. Then the converted journalist Malcolm Muggeridge. Then many Christian expository writers. He read G.K. Chesterton, F.B. Meyer, G. Campbell Morgan, particularly James Stewart of Scotland. Ravi then started doing lots with this organization, Youth for Christ. And now he energetically organized meetings for them and did a lot of work for them, sending out invitations, reaching anyone he could with this great gospel message that changed his life. Because that's what Christianity is. It's not just a life improved. It's a brand new life. It's transformed. And after his conversion, one of his good buddies, who was sure to be a real success, set himself aflame with kerosene and flamed. A few months after Ravi tried to commit suicide, and his regular buddies were all shaken to the core. One of them would be next. Who would it be? So he had to challenge them. So it says, the next day at school, some of my mates and I gathered to talk, and Ravi issued a charge to them. This was a new Ravi. And Ravi issued that charge to them, that we've got to go and get deeper than we have. He met a celebrity musician from one of the most famous bands in India. And when he met that musician, he was so filled with the Spirit, he said he couldn't even help himself but to keep sharing his faith. He couldn't stop keep sharing his faith. So he invited that celebrity musician to a Youth for Christ meeting. He never thought he was going to come, but he actually did come. And after he came, he committed his life to Christ. And so the seeds of the thrill of obedience were starting to be sown in Ravi's life, and his penchant for being able to connect that heart and mind was starting to run course. It wasn't too long until Ravi discovered the course that he wanted to take in his life as far as a career went. He wanted a career in hotel management. He loved hotels. He loves hotels. I can tell that. I've been in many, many hotels with him. And every hotel is always really the finest there is in the city. He loves the hotel industry, still does today. His dad pulled strings, got him accepted into the renowned Institute of Hotel Management in Delhi. And as a new Ravi, he excelled now in all his studies. Every subject, a Christian Ravi, business, economics, accounting, human resources management, and to everyone's surprise, including his, he was at the top of his class. He wrote that he never imagined that one day he would walk up to the principal's office because he was at the top of his class. Life was no longer purposeless and aimless for him. The plan was set. He had an undergraduate program, and he was going to get a master's degree in hotel and catering, either at Cornell University or in England. Should be followed up by a 3-year internship at a top-tier hotel. His goal was to one day be a general manager at a 5-star hotel. And then he writes, "All the things that I have thought were the causes of my despair, my failing studies, my senseless wandering, my hopelessness, had actually been the results of my despair." The Austrian concentration camp survivor Viktor Frankl wrote, "Without meaning, nothing else matters. With meaning, everything falls into place. If you can't see why, the why, you cannot live for the what." And so as soon as I was able to answer the why of my life, even my failures began to make sense. He speaks then of his ongoing studies and uncontrollable joy, of lying out in the field just giddy with joy that he can't believe this. There's a youth, at the youth speakers tournament, I always read this passage, which I won't do here, about a speaking contest. And then he talks about two people who invested into his life and into the lives of people. And he makes a note of the value of investing and grooming those behind you. And I'm not going to read it here. I really wish I could. But there's a value in investing in those behind you. And so he gives credit to those people. I've got to read a little bit more to you. Now, I'm going to go rush right through because this is important. Because I want you to start seeing where this Ravi that you know of now is. All right. Eventually, here's what happened. He started seeing a girl named Margie Reynolds. And a miraculous thing happened. He was called to Vietnam to preach. This lady heard him preach in America, in Canada, and said, "Would you be interested in going to Vietnam?" "Why?" He said, "Because they need God there. And if you feel God would go, he said, I need money and I need this, and then I would have to give up my job." And she says, just pray about it. And then, "How much money do you need?" And then next thing he knows, a week later, in the mail, he gets a check from some lady who says, "I think you might be needing this." And it's the exact money he needs. So he goes. And he writes, "When I landed in Saigon in May of 1971, I could not have felt more alone. It suddenly hit me that I was in a war-torn country. Had I considered the dangers? I was deeply in love with Margie. I had wanted to get engaged before Vietnam, but I felt nervous about doing that while facing a mission like this. The first week I stayed..." "I remember one Sunday morning service very clearly. I delivered a sermon to that day to 400 airmen who all stood in their uniforms throughout the service. They were about to leave on a mission, and the chaplain leaned over and whispered to me, 'Many, if not most, of these men will not be coming back.' At that service ended, the soldiers sang, 'It is well with my soul.' The sound of their voices and the sight of them standing there on the very edge of mortality made a profound impact on me." This is during the Vietnam War. "The very next day, one of my host missionaries came to me excited because invitations to preach were coming in from all the fringes of the country. 'It's wonderful,' he said, 'but I don't know how we're going to get to these places.'" And so they find a way and he gets there. As he's going to places, the skies are lit up with amber color of flares and firepower all around. He saw the awful sights of dead bodies lying on the ground, others strewn across from fields of ambush. At night, he and his interpreter went to bed knowing that their own lives were in danger. Heard lots of stories of killing and death. We saw the results of the destruction daily. He went to military hospitals where soldiers' bodies were badly burned or horribly maimed. Yet, with everything I saw, God kept reminding me continually that He was taking care of us and would protect us, and I was there on His mission. Vietnam was a world turned upside down, and the villages, even amongst the missionaries, men and women all slept in the same room. They were all packed together. At one point, I was scheduled to preach at a pastor's conference. The Spirit of God came upon... only a few minutes into my sermon that day, Hien, his interpreter, stopped interpreting. When I turned to see why, I noticed that he was visibly fighting back tears. The Spirit of God had come upon him, and Hien could no longer translate. I had to stop my sermon as a handful of pastors came forward and began to minister to my friend. And then something strange happened. Virtually the whole room of pastors came pouring forward, dropping to their knees in prayer. It was a shock to me. Later, I was told that when Hien stopped interpreting, he said, "What is this man saying? What this man is saying to us is true. We need to take the word of God seriously. We need God in our land. It is we, the church, that is the problem." The whole place had come under conviction. I realized the meeting was over, at least the meeting that we had planned was over, and we all knelt and prayed for a couple of hours. For the first time in my life, I was tasting the drops of revival, that moment when a group was touched from beyond the ordinary speech of word or person. And it began to happen in lots of places where I preached. Soldiers, tribal folk, Vietnamese nationals, even at the missionaries and the church leaders. I remember speaking at a Bible college where God stirred their hearts, and they also fell to their knees in prayer. Every time, I was intensely aware that I was unfit to be there. And I wonder why all these people were reacting this way. What is it that's affecting them so? Sometimes Hien and I would stay up for hours after the meeting counseling young men and women who were struggling in their faith or those who had questions about God or their lives. Sometimes it was a pastor, sometimes a soldier, sometimes a tribesman, sometimes a monk. One time we were heading, and the lady in the truck said, "We're about to enter the most dangerous area of Vietnam." That shook me. I thought, why would she tell me that? Why couldn't she wait till we had gotten through and then tell me? As we drove through the area, suddenly our car began to sputter and chug, and then it died. And just like that, we were stranded on the side of the road, four missionaries and me, with not a soul in sight. Terrified, we opened the hood and poked around trying to locate the problem, but nobody could find anything wrong. We tried everything, hoping that whatever needed repairing would be fixed as we fiddled around. We tightened what was already tight, loosened what was already loose, but nothing worked. After a while, a white Jeep appeared behind us coming up the road we had just driven. As it got closer, we tried to look friendly and waved to them to stop. But when they came upon us, they swerved around us and sped away. We all let out sighs of frustration. We couldn't blame them. They must have thought, why would anyone stop in the most dangerous part of Vietnam? So they probably were afraid of an ambush, so they left. We had no choice but to stand by the roadside and to pray. Then someone tried the engine again, and this time it started. Immensely grateful, we quickly climbed back into the Jeep and continued down the road. But after driving a few miles, we came upon that white Jeep again. As we approached, we saw that it had been overturned, and the bodies of the four passengers were strewn across the side of the road, bullet-riddled and dead. In the distance, we could see the Viet Cong still scurrying away, and we realized that we couldn't stop. We had to drive on. God has an appointment with each of us, and it is critical that every man and woman know this. He will stop our steps when it is not our time. He will lead us when it is. This is a reassuring truth to know for every believer and a necessary trust for anyone who ministers in great areas of risk. Oh, I wish I could tell you now the ending. So much more. And I can't. There's just stories of when he was invited to the geopolitical center of army strategy in Russia when it was communist country. And then the General Kirshen was there, and it was not a Christian. And then after they had talked, he became a Christian, invited him to Russia. And then he was there in front of all these atheists, heads of military, and all staring him down and kind of making trouble. And one guy, while he was giving his talk in the room, kept giving him the choke sign. And then Robbie was kind of unnerved by it. But then they became Christian, story after story after story. I wish I could read these things to you. Of people coming to Christ, how they came, people you wouldn't even hardly imagine. And I wish I could tell you more. He went back and went to seminary, actually, quit his job after he got to Vietnam, quit his food job. And he said, there's an old rabbinic saying that you have two sets of parents. the one who brought you into the world, the ones who brought you into the world, and the ones who brought you into the knowledge of the Lord. For him, his seminary professors were the latter. There's this great story of counting the cost in Cambodia. Oh, man. Oh, he's reuniting with his interpreter. Oh, these are amazing stories. The Muslim who was about to commit suicide, and as he was on his deathbed, ready to commit suicide and slit his wrists, he heard a message from Ravi that talked exactly about his committing suicide, was going to commit suicide, and he was so enraptured by it, he turned his life over to the Lord. And, I mean, there's just story after story, lots of them, that I could tell you that he's personally just said. But I can't do that all right now. I think I've run through it. Let me tell you what I want you to take from our time here. So please listen. I know you've been patient, and I thank you for it. But I want you to take from this time this, that God is involved in every area of your life. God has a master plan for the world that he's executing, and you have a role in his story. You are living at exactly the right time, exactly the right place in history, right exactly where he wants you to live. You are in the exact family, in the exact circumstances that are handpicked for you. There's a person that you are to become and a kingdom work that you are to fulfill. There are specific people that he's planning for you to rub shoulders with, to be friends with, to be in community with, to bless you and to, that you can bless, to teach and to who he wants to teach you. I want you to know that he will seek you out. He's in the shadows lurking, always there, watching out for you. He is preparing the way for you. He is putting specific circumstances, specific people, specific events in your life to just highlight how amazing he is, and so you can say thank you. Jeremiah 29:11, you well know, says, "For I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord. Plans to prosper you, not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future." In preparing for this, I was in communication with Ravi. He says, "Dear Arthur, it's always good to hear from you. I'm sure Nathaniel's life, would have been further enriched by being in Romania. You have an amazing family, and you are so blessed. I thank God for you. Sorry I didn't get back to you further." See what I'm telling you about the word? It's always trying to. I'm in Singapore right now. I'll be here until August 1st. From here, I go straight to South Africa. If you're on the next Friday, I was trying to get an interview time just to talk on the phone with him. He says, it's going to be really, really tight. You'd have to call me at my hotel in Pretoria, South Africa. I said, "It's okay, Robbie. Don't have to do that." Because I was telling him we're doing a series called Standing on the Shoulders of Giants. He closes this first email. He says, "Let me know if that's going to work for you to call me, in South Africa." But one disclaimer, he says, "I am afraid a giant I am not. The Lord has chosen the weakest of the weak when he called me, and that is the truth. Blessings, dear friend. Love to the family, Ravi." He wrote back last night with six things to tell you at Total Devotion specifically. If you go on our TD website, there's actually a kind of a little slice that he gives for us. If you go on there, you'll see it. It's right to TD. It's right to you. But this came last night as I asked him, "Okay, well, my youth group, and what would you want to tell them?" So here he is telling you. Number one, I think most importantly, we need to realize how important the role is of a parent with a struggling child. Without my mother, I would not have made it. Number two, the place of people in your spiritual journey is key. The place of people in your spiritual journey is key. There are those who can lead you to the path of truth and those to the path of error. Who you listen to determines your choices. Number three, I truly believe that when you search for him with all your heart, you will find him. Number four, God works on a timetable with his plan. We must understand this. Our role is to trust him and to serve him with a total dedication. I would tell him, "You should have wrote Total Devotion." But you got to understand that. His time, his plan, his goal is always the best for you. You just need to obey and serve him with your whole heart. Number five, There may be many mysteries in serving God. But remember, there are greater unresolved issues in rejecting Him. There may be many mysteries in serving God, but there are greater unresolved ones in rejecting Him. And number six, my greatest fulfillment lies in knowing that He cared so deeply to pursue me when I had no interest in finding Him. Now God's plan for my life is the most profound longing of my heart. Thanks so much, Arthur. I've been so busy, and the signal here in Pretoria keeps coming only sporadically. Blessings, brother. Oh, I wish I could tell you of the amazing, amazing, amazing stories. They would just put shivers on your... But what He will do with a life sold out to His. Ravi has a very disciplined life of waking up early in the morning just to be before Him and studying, always in prayer. When He's preparing to speak at a venue, I remember calling His office when he was, the week that he's supposed to speak at Yale, and his assistant told me he's studying all the books of the authors of Yale, so he knows the culture well. He's praying over his impact in this world, and when anyone is incredible, I don't even know how to explain it to you. But what I'm saying is that he was just a little punk who God got a hold of. And when God got a hold of him, his life was never the same and was able to be used phenomenally. If God gets a hold of your life and you surrender, wave the white flag and just give in. Follow him with all your heart. Your life will be more spectacular than you could ever dream or plan or want. I'm just a little microcosm of that. I can't even hold Ravi's paper bag for him. I can't. But I'm telling you, relative to my own situation, my life is spectacular relative to my own context. Blessing me far and beyond anything I could have ever mustered or dreamed up. My life is so much more amazing than I could ever, that could have ever come from my life. And I'm telling you, it's true for people that I know of who are coming to surrender. It will happen for you as you embrace the gospel, receive the forgiveness of your sins, become a new creation, and set on a new path that He has for you. With Him, you don't lose, because Christians don't lose. And I pray that that's what you'll get from His life. Oh, I wish I could tell you so much more. But let's pray. Lord God, as I asked in the beginning of this talk, I ask that you would break down some of the doors that are being propped up. Propped up to hold on to vestiges of trinkets. Treasures await some of these people, these dear friends in this room. But they won't let go of the trinkets, God. They hold on to their own self-acclaim and their own little man-made achievements that really are like little things you find in a Cracker Jack box. And there you are outside with precious gold waiting for them. They're holding on to sewer water in their cups. And you've got rivers of living water out there for them. And they buy into the lie. They continue to feed themselves on this world's entertainment. They continue to amuse themselves with the stuff that means nothing. That they will not carry with them to eternity. God, I know your heart hurts and aches. And I know that you want to snatch them. And maybe for some, the time is now. If they receive you, surrender to you, admit their sin and their folly and their waywardness and their purposelessness and their rebellion and their shaking their fist at you and giving you the finger all their lives. And that they know now that that's all been a sham. Lord, help them to know that you sent your one and only Son to live, to die, to rise again in power. And for every Christian here, as Romans says, the power that raised Jesus Christ from the dead is now within us. Oh God, would you please help them to see that that could be theirs. And that they can make you make something beautiful of their lives that goes way beyond their self-aggrandizement and superficial little flavors of nothingness. That you are everything and you want to fill them to the full, to the brim, and want them to spill over with meaning and with that same power and with resurrection life. And that you want them to be useful and effective, and that they would be able to splash over into the world, and that when they meet with people, people get affected because they met with them. Not them, but you in them. Lord, if there's anyone here tonight that is yours, that you've been calling and are calling by name, I pray that we would have a conversation with them tonight. For the rest, Lord, challenge us. Challenge and provide us and make us who you need us to be. Life is so short here. We don't have time to dilly-dally. And the life of full abundance and pleasure in you is awaiting. I pray that they would start early and young so that they can have a full life of life everlasting. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen and amen. Okay. Thank you. I set a record, but I pray that that would be...